We were talking about Operation Epsom, and we'd got through the overnight lager on 26th, 27th. Some general points about lagers we had. And now I want to move on to the 27th, which is the second day, when basically you did the same again. You attacked Shire again. But this time A Squadron was in the lead and seems to have had a big clash with a group of Panthers and claimed several Panthers and Tigers and all sorts of things. Now, do you remember any of that in detail, or is it just an impression again?
That day would be very similar to the one before. It was General Scutton about going at targets that had been selected from others that had a go, and their shots were bouncing. So they would give you the reference of it, and you'd have to move to a position where you could go for them. We obviously scored something as you did, Dom Sandler, sort of give a little cry of joy, as it were. We did something.
Were you whilst operating again?
Operating again that day. You got this little cry of joy, you know. By the time you got that out, you were at another target, so it all. It was a rolling sort of thing that I suppose mayhem would be the best word I could use, really. It's the same as the day before.
Anything stand out at all?
Not too much.
So, the lager again, which we've dealt with, and then on the 28th, things moved slightly because you crossed the Odon and went forward. This is where you started moving towards point 112. I'm not quite sure of the, but you certainly crossed the Odon
I remember the bridge and driving up, because Hill 112, is its number in flight, the hill, and you went up. Once you got over the bridge, it was a climb. There were self-propelled guns. The Germans had self-propelled guns to cover that, but we managed to sort of get through that and up, clambered up on top of the hill.
Wireless operator again. You were wireless operator,
right, on that occasion, yeah.
That was throughout the whole of Goodwood, Epsom, it sounds like.
Well, we did swap once we were dug in.
Oh, right, fair enough, sorry. Yeah. So, where did you dig it? You approached the thing. You don't remember how the self-propelled guns...
They were cleared.
By cleared, does it mean got, or does it mean they left?
I think it was a bit of each, actually. Some were got, and the others pulled back. Because.
Did you have an opinion about the self-propelled guns as a weapon?
They were pretty fearsome. If there was one lurking about, you would always try and get it out of the way, because it was certainly a nuisance value to you, that's for sure. They were fairly formidable, and being self-propelled, they could move like tanks. The self-propelled is only a gun platform, in truth. They were formidable.
Now, you moved up onto the hill. How steep was it? I mean,
quite steep. Yeah, it's quite a climb, a drag up there. And then it flattens out, if I remember, at the top.
And you dug in, you say? Yeah. Now, what do you mean by that?
One of our Shermans had a bulldozer blade on the front, and it actually came up and it dug what would be a pit, a ramp. Once the ramp was dug, you drove into it, and you were then just hull down, as the expression is, only the turret showing above the level. So we were dug in.
Now, the point of that was?
It was just like a static gun that was difficult to sort of see, because you only had the turret sticking out. I don't know, there was only about four of us. So dug in little slots up the top there.
And what could you see from your position? Because you would get a look out of there, I presume.
Well, you would, yeah. This Carpiki airdrome was in the distance, which seemed sort of like a great play. I could see it. you being high, you had a big view over the countryside beyond it, and this aerodrome didn't have anything on it because there's no movement down there, it seemed to play an important part there, competing.
Now, the thing makes reference to a fair amount of mortar and German mortar and shell fire.
It was permanent. It seemed that it was always in the air, it was always coming over. You had it constant, mortar fire.
With their angle of approach, would you have the thing shut, the turret shut?
Very rarely.
She took your chance.
Yeah, very rarely. If you got it, I mean the commanders near was out there open anyway, with the Firefly you had the benefit of one, but I didn't shut it very often, that's for sure.
Did the shells ever hit the tank in that time?
No, they were so close. I blew lumps of your bedding off.
Off the back.
Yeah, off the back. Or if you didn't, shrapnel would penetrate it. So when you unrolled the BB, there'd be holes all through it, and blankets would have got torn up. And the boxes that we had welded on the front, we lost one of those. It got blown away, and there was all trigger in there, like tent pegs and all the bits and bobs, and that all went. All stuff on the outside, you lost some old bits. The old tank would rock a little bit, but never hit us, although we had close ones.
Now, there were the four of you, was it on the top? Four or five, yeah. Dug in, hull down, and then it says here that they dug in on the, that would be perhaps the 28th, the third day. The day that was the same day as you crossed the Odon then?
No.
You'd stay there another couple of days.
Yeah.
And the next day it says just observing German movements. So
when we dug in, it came out on the air that they couldn't supply us they couldn't get the supplies through because the Germans had actually cut the bridge again, the path back. So we couldn't be supplied, so we left out there. At night, actually, that was the weird thing, was the fact that down the slope, the Germans were down the slope, and you could actually hear them refueling their vehicles, throwing cans about. You could hear them actually talking. Whether that was done bravado or whatever, but you could certainly hear them. It was quite, I suppose, when the wind was in the right direction, you could pick them up. And also, and this must have been bravado, you'd hear them start up, you'd hear the track start to move, and then after a minute or so, they'd stop and switch off. It's a war of nerves, probably, but that's what they used to play at, and I can clearly remember hearing them sort of throw, as if they were refueling, and calling to one another and chatting. I think the bit that really got you worried is when you heard the engine start and the old tracks start rolling. You're not sure whether it's coming up, going down, or whatever.
Then, so that was overnight,
yeah,
but there were no attacks that night. And then next day, you stayed up there, did you? All day?
Yeah, we seemed to be up there for a while. We didn't come off then until the evening, late in the evening. It was almost getting dark. During that day, and I swapped with the gunner, and I was in the turret, and we had a report from one of the dug-in tanks on our left that something was moving behind a hedge, and it was moving in our direction, and it came up twice, I think, on the radio. This thing's still moving, it's still coming your direction. And you've got to remember that this had happened frequently, and you fired something that you thought was there. And if you checked, you'd find it was a cow or something like that, which, no doubt, a lot of cows usually get killed like this. But on this occasion, the second call came up and it's still moving and it's coming your direction. So we fired a couple of HE to punch a hole in a hedge. And this is quite vivid to me, even now. We were scanning this area that we thought it was coming. And I held the gun near enough where I thought it might be, if it was moving at that sort of speed. It was only a guesstimate. But whilst looking, with the gun sitting as it was, through the hedge came a sprocket and a tank, the nose of the tank, edge on, coming out oblique, with the tank climbing up to get over the bank. And that wasn't just visible in the periscope, it was visible in my sight. And if it moved another foot up, I banged the shot off, which was armour piercing. It hit it right behind the sprocket. It was a Mark IV. But the thing I can remember most was that the Mark IV had a small cupola on the top of it with visual slides like we have periscopes built into it, and it was actually moving. The commander must have been moving it around at that point as I fired, and he must have looked straight down the barrel of the firefly. That must have been his vision as it went. It rolled back, we punched another shot in where we thought it might be, and it literally rolled back.
Did you see any visual effect of the shell that hit it, the first one?
Only a load of dust went up from around it. Funny enough, afterwards, whenever those tank was hit, you always got a big shower of dust go up. Who knows where it all come from, but you had this hue of dust from the shot, the impact of it, because at that point, that 17-pounder only went, you know, a few yards before it hit this thing.
About what range are we talking?
Well, we're only talking about 80 yards, I should think. You're not far. Not far. But yeah, it just rolled back. They had a look through the hedge when there was a lull, and there wasn't much in the way of lulls out there, but it seemed that all the hatches were shut. So where the second shot hit it in the turret, and I know not. But it was what I remember clearly. It was the thing just popped up in your sight. You didn't have to do anything virtually other than hit the button. Never happened before or since, you know. It's one of those strange things. But I thought then later that when that commander spun that cupola around, he must have looked straight down the barrel.
Did it worry you what had happened to the crew, or what presumably had happened to the crew?
It's a very difficult question, that, you know.
More then than now, I think, possibly, you know, thinking
now
about...
Now I would, but not then. You were just glad to get it out of the way. I mean, it was something that was a problem. It was going to be a problem, and it was dealt with, you know.
Did you rate the Mark IV? I mean, although it was an older German tank, I'm not sure it was much worse than a Sherman. I mean, what did you think of it? Or did you know anything about it?
Not too much. I mean, I recognised what it was as the sprocket came through, as it sort of came out into view. But it was always outclassed by the Panther and obviously the Tiger.
But what about relevance to the... Did you see, yes, it was outclassed by then, but was it outclassed by the Sherman?
About equal terms, if you like. I honestly think equal. No better, no worse. But you'd have to ask a German crew under that, I guess.
Now, anything else happened while you were up there, while you were on the gun? What else did you open fire? And did you use your Browning? Or?
No, there was no infantry. Funny enough, that episode, once we'd done that, there were no real more. Being about 80 yards back, you're not looking down a hill, and you couldn't lower your gun down very low anyway. So attacks had to come to you.
So you weren't on the top of the hill or over the hill. You were on the reverse. You were on the
plateau at the top.
And 80 yards back.
We were about 80 yards.
And there was this hedge on the edge of the...
That's right. And,
you had no infantry covering you at all then?
They were some up there, some rifle brigade.
Where were they?
Cool. They were up on the plateau, and there was a half-track up there with them, and one of the mortars went into the back. It dropped into the back of that, I remember, that going up. But they were on foot before there was, digging in like mad. But there weren't many of them, or if they were, you didn't see them. It wasn't an infantry sort of situation at that point.
Now, I'm trying to get clear how many days you're up on, because it's quite difficult to tell. On the 28th, they crossed the Odon, and then were overnight, and then, according to this, there was a whole day up there, and then on the next day after that, so they would say you were there half a day, then a whole day, then another half day, and came down the last night.
You came down the last night.
Would you be up there two night days?
Yeah, I reckon.
Two or 3 days?
Well, at least a couple.
Right, so you're not quite sure about how... No, yeah. No. Anything else happened while you were up there? Or this was the last thing, this Mark IV?
Yeah, this Mark IV. The hedge that was directly in front of it, but it dropped away, and you could actually look out over the... Let's say the Airdrome, the Carpiki,
so you could see a long way away,
yeah,
but you couldn't see something that was 120
no.
yards away.
No, that's true.
So what happened? Why were you pulled back?
Well, it came up on the radio I don't know who it was, that they were attacking the self-propelled guns that had got back in and were controlling the bridge. And then later on, and it was fairly late in the hour, we were told that to come back, to return down across the bridge.
Did you cross the same bridge?
Yes. But when we told to move...
Was it a retreat? I mean...
Get off. You call it what you will, but it was a retreat. We did get off and move back. And under the circumstances, probably quite happy to. When we were told to get off, the Sherman had what they called a home light for charging your batteries when your engine wasn't running.
How did that work?
It was a little home light. It got its name. It was a little portable generator that was evidently developed and used in America where there wasn't access to electricity. So they had one of these things on the farmhouse or whatever, and it would give you light. Well, this was converted to charge the battery. And it was stowed at the back of the turret, and the turret was cut away so that if you moved the gun in a certain position, you could then get this home light, and it had a little outboard motor. You actually had a cord, and it petrolled the oil mixture, you fired it like you would a little outboard motor, and then it would rev enough and that would charge your batteries while you were static. Well, when we came to come off this hill, we got the orders to get off. We started and we started reversing out, but one of the other vehicles near us in it dug car down, it couldn't start. So we then had to get out, take the tow rope and go over and pull him back, and then put the tow rope around the front to tow him off to give him a tow start. And what a performance that was. It was all ratted up there, and dragging hawsers about with spits still flying about. It wasn't the best place to be, but...
Still under mortar fire, then?
There was still some stuff coming down, but it wasn't as heavy and intense as it had been previously. But I can clearly remember dragging this hauler about and trying with the anchor shackles and the like. I would try to get a flat battery, you know. I mean, you curse a flat battery, best of times up there.
But you couldn't restart it using the home, I mean, you couldn't recharge it, or did that take ages?
No, it took too long. The idea was to do it when fairly early on, the driver would say, "Hello, we're taking too much out of the battery. We're going to keep the home light in."
Had they just forgotten to do that then, or was it broken?
I wouldn't have known. Because your radio takes a certain amount out of the battery anyway. It's this constant drain on it, and they might have just missed it or whatever. It might not have worked. They were a bit temperamental, these things, I must admit, but useful. They were useful.
Now, as you pulled off and to cross the Odon, you went across the same bridge, did you?
We came across the bridge, yeah. I would say it was the same. But it was virtually dark then.
And you didn't see any German self-propelled...
We came off out of the lift. We came down there flying, you know. Full pelt, that's for sure. Because just happy to get away, I guess. But we all got off, to my knowledge.
And that's when I think you went back to Norrie, so you wouldn't know. And there was, two or three days with mortar and shell fire. So do you remember any of that?
No. I mean, whatever followed from up there, it was less intense. Yes, it was. Really got off, and it seemed to be in comparative quiet, you know, compared to what we'd previously gone through.
They then went to somewhere called Colville, and, again, and this is into July, and the odd bit of moving forward, backwards and forwards, cleaning the tanks at Camilli, and then the next big thing's Goodwood. But before Goodwood, is there anything else you remember in that sort of period of not such intense activity? Because it went on for about 15 days, 20 days.
I think after Hill 112, when we got back and you went quiet and you had a good clean-up and the rest of it...
Now, when you started the move towards Goodwood, there's quite a concentration on camouflaging your positions as you moved, because it was...
We actually formed up in the orchard, tucked in under the trees, and great play was made of this camouflaging being as good as it could be. In fact, regular... walks were taken by the officers to walk around and view the camouflage techniques used.
And what were they?
That was the big net that we had. We carried, you'd throw them over the tank, and then you'd cover that with leaves, branches, and you tucked it, the tank, right in under the cover of the leaf, whatever. But they did make great play on that, that's for sure. Regular looks around, keep touring around, viewing it from different angles. Because, no doubt about it, Germans used to go over checking fields and whatever. And without doubt, they had their spot of play with that. Yeah, they took a
and while you were here, this is when you changed crew, before Goodwood, wasn't it?
Yeah.
How did that come about?
We had replacement crews coming up and joining us to pump the numbers back up, and I was asked to see Major Powell, and he asked me then to change crews from, I think it was a corporal's crew that I joined.
Do you know his name? The corporal.
No, I can't think.
Which troop was it in? Was it still in Steele Brownlee's troop?
I think it was, yes. I think it was. It was Steele. But it was a new crew, so I swapped with their radio operator. I'm not so sure. Was somebody else changed as well, the co-driver possibly, but we did the swap. It's just a question of taking your kit, your roll, your bedroll, and and obviously the whole thing just again rechecking that everything was there on this new vehicle.
And you were the wireless operator gunner, or gunner and wireless?
I was the wireless operator on that.
Just the wireless operator. And what about, which tank was it? Was this another Firefly?
That was Sherman. An old Sherman. Yeah, it's just come up from the holding unit. You know, filters up, as it were.
And anything else before the actual Goodwood?
Yeah. Well, we moved out of this orchard and we moved up and the run up to where we were going, it was dust. It threw up enormous clouds of dust. Everything and everybody was smothered in it. In fact, I think we more or less had a put a mask over your face to try and stop it. It was enormous. The trailer vehicles, as you moved along, it was like moving through a fine fog with this fine dust. But in the move up, on the run up to Goodwood, during this dust, the driver of this show reported that his oil pressure had gone. So we pulled over and we radioed up and said we had an engine problem. So and we pulled up quite out of line, and the driver said could we check the oil. Now the oil for the Sherman is in the back of the turret. You had to move the turret around to get the opening, and the oil tank was tucked up in the behind it. So I got down and undid the cap of the oil, and out came blue glycol. So I slammed the cap back on, and it's antifreeze coming out of the oil. So
how could you tell? Sorry, I mean
it's dark, but the antifreeze is liquid. It's thin, you know. I mean, the oil has got some viscosity to it. And as it took the cap off, so it all came flooding over. We put the lid down and then reported we've got an engine problem.
Who'd put the antifreeze in?
Well, the tank already holds antifreeze for the cooling system anyway. It's the water system. Cooling.
But who'd put it in the oil?
That we didn't know at that point. It was only when the engine was taken out that we found the reason. But so there we were sitting aside the road with this engine failure. Although the engine would actually run, but it was obviously noisy. And we were told to wait then for the LAD, I suppose it was, the wheelie to come up and have a look at it. So we were then still being shelled every time a vehicle went past through a cloud of dust, this dust up, and they were still throwing over shells, but so you were jumping in and out every time something went past. Eventually the big old scale that the LAD had came lumping up, and it towed us out to a forward wing, but station. It wasn't far back, but they set to work looking at it and decided that we needed, it was a new engine required. We had to unload all the ammunition because they weren't too happy about clambering about with all the ammo still in there. We removed that and parked it, and while they started dismantling the engine with the truck, they had a truck, and two, a couple of us went down with them. We had to go back to the beach, right to the sand actually, and there they reported to somebody, and they came back with an identification number because along the sand or along the beach were pegs and markers, and we drove along the lane that they created at the back of it to the marker, and sure enough, there in the sand was the big box, Sherwin engine. It's incredible, really, but some order does prevail, you know, which is